Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW
106.5 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Who else would I be? Co-hosting today is Mr. John Copenhaver. How are you doing, John?
I am fabulous. How are you, Al?
Well, I'm not anything close to you, but I mean, my book's in the same bathroom, but I have you. So now, so you were at the Sleuth Fest or whatever that
Sleuth Fest. Yes, it's in, it was in Boca Raton this year. It's kind of a crime conference focus. It really focuses on, you know, I guess education, or rather I should say, you know, teaching people how to write. It's more of a writer centric, I guess, regional, conference. It was lovely. It was a good event. I really enjoyed myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw some good authors there. I saw Alan Orloff. He's always fun.
Yeah. That was great.
Good writer and stuff like that. But so what were you doing there?
I was presenting on a few panels, and I got to read at Noir at the Bar from The Savage Kind, and yeah, just doing those sorts of things. We had a panel on how to write killer characters, and another panel on, you know, whether you should choose a sleuth to write about or a PI to write about. Amateur detective or a PI to write about, and so. Which was interesting. We just kind of cover different topics.
Wow. Did you have your hair all done and your nails and stuff? Cause you're like the Lambda Winter Star. And
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I did a full spa day and, someone dressed me for my events and
big entourage.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yes. Several limousines. Yeah.
Everyone thought it was Lady Gaga coming.
Yeah, they're like, you know, it must be Lady Gaga, and I know it's John Copenhaver.
Yeah. Well, that's nice.
I'm just lucky if I get a chance to clip my toenails these days, Al. Well,
you know, that's nice, but you know, and so now speaking of Lady Gaga, we've got instead we didn't get her, so don't. Everyone sit down again. We got at Lady Anne Aptaker. So thanks for being here, Anne.
Well, thank you. Gosh, I'm not Lady Gaga, but I'll try and do my best to be just as fabulous. though I don't wear high heel shoes, but let's just say this way, I would date Lady Gaga. So how about that?
Okay, well, there we go. That's close.
Close enough.
Close enough. As close as we're
I think I might date Lady Gaga.
Oh, please. Oh. Get in line, John. Get in line.
Yeah, and you have to stop dressing like her, or, you know, she's not going to date someone that looks like her. Come on. So, but Anne, you have that great lifestyle. You've won all these awards, and you're in Paris every year. And my God, you are very, very well-to-do, exceptional writer. What do you think people get wrong about you the most?
What they get wrong is actually quite a lot. They think I'm nice, and I disabuse them of that. I'm kind to people, and I'm courteous, and I try and do my best to be, a reasonable human being. But when you're a writer, you're just innately selfish, right, John? Right, Al? And you know, everything that comes out of everybody's mouth, you absorb and take in, and they just have to be prepared that it will come back at them. When they're reading about themselves being killed off by crime writers such as ourselves. Other than that, what if people get wrong about me? Well, because I go to Paris every year, where I stay in a friend's apartment free of charge, which is awfully nice of her to do. I just sort of, contribute to the household food and that sort of thing, but it's rent free. Lucky me. So there's this sensation, I guess, that people have that I have this very glamorous life. Well, Paris is 3 months out of my year. And then the rest of the year, it's kind of, I'm looking very closely at a bench in Port Authority bus terminal, something like that.
Well, whose place do you stay at in Paris? Is that Gaga's place?
You guessed. Oh, my God.
That's the friend.
Well, I can't tell you. It's the old expression. I would tell you, but then I'd have to kill you because she's very secretive. But she goes by another name in Paris, and I cannot reveal it.
Oh, well, there we go. See, it's very big. Lady Gugu. So where do you do? Is that where you do your writing? That's interesting. Do you do your writing when you're there in Paris in Gaga's apartment for 3 months?
I wish it was Gaga's apartment. although the apartment that I'm in is a very dear friend, and it's every bit as good as Gaga's apartment. It's every bit as loving and warm and wonderful. But yes, I do write when I'm there. I also write when I'm not there. The only way to turn out a book is to write constantly, and it takes me anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years or more to write each book. So yes, I write when I'm in Paris. In fact, the book that's out now, Hunting Gold, and the book that preceded it, Murder in Gold, were written largely in Paris, not completely, but largely. And when I'm back there this September, October, and November, I'll be researching a book actually that's going to take place in Paris at the early stages of World War II. So that, that's going to be taking up a lot of my time, is doing actually on-site research and also writing the book.
Yeah, it would. I find this an interesting time period. Plus, like in this new book you've got, this is book 6
of the
Tanter Gold crime series.
Right.
And you're talking about, the American dream, in the conformist 1950s and same-sex romance. So when you get into that, do you have a point to that? Like where does this come from?
Well, it comes from, I guess, all of our life experience in the LGBTQ world. And I set the series in the 1950s when it was absolutely illegal for us to live an out life. And Cantor Gold refuses to be subjected to those kinds of oppressive laws if she can avoid it. In a way, she can't avoid it, but what she says is the big no. She says, I'm not going to live like that. She lives as an out lesbian. Very dapper. She has her clothes custom tailored, and she's just out there, and she can afford it because she's decided, as many of my readers know, she's decided that if the law is going to identify her as a criminal, essentially just for who she takes to dinner and who she takes to bed, essentially just for living, that instead of living on the right side of the law and being, say, a legitimate art dealer, she becomes an art thief and a smuggler. And she's very successful at it. She makes gobs of money. And the money, of course, protects her somewhat from the oppressions of the law. So it allows me as a writer to address those issues without sort of beating the reader over the head with it. It's still a crime story, a murder mystery, a whodunit and all of that. But I want my readers to be heavily invested emotionally in Cantor and her world. So I hope that answers your question. I didn't lose the thread or the thing.
No, no.
This new book, if I may, this new book, that the latest one, Hunting Gold, which actually releases officially tomorrow. Well, tomorrow from the time that we're recording this. So tomorrow would be July 12th. I don't know when this is going to air. But in any event, the dedication page for that book is, this book is dedicated to everyone who insists on having a place in the world. And in this book, Cantor's place in the world as a human being is being stalked and challenged and threatened. And I think in these times, even though I write about this book takes place in 1955, that situation, of course, is really still relevant to all of us today in the LGBTQ world. Our rights are very definitely being threatened, and our place in the world, therefore, is being threatened. So someone like Cantor Gold comes along and says, no, you're not going to threaten me in the world. And I hope that the readers become, you know, very emotionally invested, not only gay readers, but straight readers, any readers. We all have our threats against us, whether we're members of a minority community or not. You know, the world is not an easy place to live. And somebody like Cantor Gold comes along and she can carry the mantle for all of us to give the powers that be the big no. You know, we're going to live our lives despite your best efforts to crush us. And that would be true for anybody.
But there must be a difference. Like in today's date, you know, there's the Supreme Court problem and the Donald Trump and all that sort of thing. But I doubt that we'll ever go back to being where it's illegal. I don't see that going that far.
Well, I hope you're right. But, you know, I don't feel as confident. I don't feel as comfortable. I don't feel as confident as you are in saying that it won't go back to making us illegal again. I think the threat of that is out there. Now, whether that actually happens, I don't know. You know, I think the chances are 50-50. The difference would be, at the time that we were illegal, we weren't fully organized yet to fight back. That's kind of was on the horizon. And in Murder and Gold, the book that preceded this current one, Cantor actually talks about that. It was the beginnings of the homosexual rights movement, which is what that was called at the time. But, they, you know, people were not as organized as we are today. Now, if we were to be declared by the Supreme Court illegal again, we have the tools, the political tools, to fight back in a way that Cantor's generation in the 1950s did not. So you may be right in that we won't suffer being illegal again, but I don't have the confidence that they won't try. I think they will try.
Yeah.
But I don't know how far they'll get.
Yeah.
And we certainly will fight back.
I think the other thing too, Anna, is that there's more cultural capital now than perhaps before.
Yes.
It doesn't matter. It's scary.
Yeah.
And whenever you feel your rights are being threatened, you feel scared, but you feel, you know, somehow that like less than. And so that's why I think characters like Cantor is really important, that sort of, they suddenly have a fight in them, you know, I'm going to be myself no matter what.
Yeah, and she does. That's exactly her. Her whole, I think of her as a life force. I don't want to make her sound too serious all the time. Like when she is the big no, she tells the authority, but she loves life. She enjoys her life. And I think that's very important in her character for the reader, that here's this person from a marginalized group who fights every day to stay alive, both because the government wants to criminalize her and because the underworld where she thrives, though, is a very difficult place to live. I mean, she lives in the world of killers and thugs and con artists and all of that. Now, she thrives there, but it's not an easy place. Nevertheless, with all of these burdens on her, which she handles sometimes well and sometimes heartbreakingly, nevertheless, she really enjoys life, and she enjoys life because she's taken control of it, because she has given the oppressors the big no. And she knows the difference between rights and freedom. She's claimed freedom for herself, even though that freedom can be taken away by arrest and all of that, but she's claimed it internally for herself, whereas rights can only be granted by the people who have the authority to grant them. And she doesn't wait that long for an LGBTQ, you know, civil rights kind of push. She says, I'm going to live my life now and take the risk of being imprisoned or worse, the psycho ward in those days. Mm-hmm. And so she really is a life force. She insists on enjoying living. And that's her strength, really. It's not only that she's defiant in the face of oppression. She insists on enjoying life. And I think that I really hope that that's what readers connect with. And I think it is.
Who do you use as an inspiration for this, or do you, for this character?
There's no one person who is an inspiration for it, for her. She really is a complete product of my imagination. She's a character that has been formulating in my mind for years before I ever put pen to paper, and various permutations of her sort of filtered around in my mind until she finally emerged whole, you know, like Athena emerging from Zeus's head. That's kind of how she was birthed. But as far as the style of the books and the punch of the books and the feel of them and, you know, the dark side of them while they still have this golden glow. I'm very much influenced by the golden age writers of American crime fiction. James M. Cain, Cornell Woolrich, that whole class of, you know, Raymond Chandler, all those folks were my influence. And then in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, when a lot of lesbian literature, Sub Rosa, started coming out, and I sort of was made aware that, hey, gee whiz, there are lesbians on the page feeling out and proud, or not so out and proud sometimes, suffering for it, but insisting on living their lives. The two of those two literary concepts came together for me and gave me the influence and the direction that I could then go as a new author writing another dyke character to add to the canon of dyke detectives, so to speak, even though she's a criminal.
Oh, you know, but she had the ability to act differently. How do I say this? So
how do you say it?
Yeah. What do you say? No, but in the 50s, mm-hmm. I think the big point for me, and maybe for young listeners who don't understand the difference in timing for LGBT and Q and anybody else. But in the 50s, Cantor was stuck with the part of, she could be arrested. Mm-hmm. Just for being gay.
That's right.
This wasn't about, okay, maybe marriage wasn't considered valid. This is about just your freedom. And like you said, a lot of people in my research that I've done in these times, there was a lot of people that thought that you were sick, you know, psychologically sick. So you should be locked up or put into an institute. So I think that's, so she had a much bigger risk. Mm-hmm. I would say, than let's say a lesbian of 2022.
Indeed, she did. And her way of handling that is by subverting the risk, by living outside the mainstream, you know, by actually adopting the life of a criminal. So she lives in a different world. She can, because her clients, you know, she's an art thief. So her clients are wealthy collectors and museums and, you know, all of the people who live on the legitimate side of life. So she can navigate both worlds, the upper world and the lower world. She navigates them very well. And in that way, and of course, by earning so much money, so she can afford, you know, a very good lawyer. And, you know, we all know that money protects people. She can subvert the risk. But she can't escape it altogether. In all of the books, there's one cop or another who would like nothing better than to finally collar her and put her away. But she's been savvy enough to be able to elude that. She's, you know, it's not so much that she's smarter than they are as much as she knows how to elude them. And she, you know, she just, you know, she decided she's not a victim. And so when you decide you're not a victim, then you're not one, if you know what I mean. And, you know, if you, she doesn't give the cops any rope with which to hang her, even though they know damn well she's guilty of sin of thievery and smuggling.
Now, I don't know about you, but I always felt years ago, like in the 80s and even the early 90s, so I don't know about the 50s, but I always felt closer to the community, and I felt the community was much more together than they are today.
Gosh, you know, I don't know. You're talking about the 50s or later?
Well, even right, you see, because I can only go by my own experience of like uh-huh. the 80s, of course, because that's my age point.
Yeah. Right.
But the 50s, I wasn't around.
Right.
So, but I'm just wondering what the community, if there was even a sense of community back then, because in the 80s, we sort of felt underground. You know, you sort of knew other people that were gay, and it was not something that you all talked about a lot.
Yeah, it was similar in the 50s. The earliest books, the first book in the series comes out in, took place in 1949, when there really was no real organized. I mean, there was a little bit here and a little bit there, some stuff going out on in San Francisco, that sort of thing, but no real organized situation. And yes, the gay community kind of knew each other, but very sub rosa. By the time you get to the early 50s and then the mid 50s, you had the Mattachine Society and then the Daughters of Bilitis for the lesbians. It was the earliest stirrings of what was called at the time the homosexual rights movement. And then as you move into the 60s and 70s with the general civil rights movement, and feminism, you know, the LGBT community strengthened in one respect. But on the lesbian side of the house, it was actually, it took a long battle for the feminists to recognize us as part of that political struggle. But in any event, by the time you get to the late 50s and into the 60s, the gay community, both on, you know, in the whole LGBTQ spectrum, was starting to get more organized. So Cantor, actually, she has some questions about this. On the one hand, she thinks it's, you know, a grand idea to fight back and all of that. I mean, you know, it's quite sort of a no-brainer. On the other hand, since she has thrived as a criminal and taken her life into her own hands, she asks, well, gee, what's the trade-off? Do I really want to become part of the mainstream world, criminal or otherwise? Because she recognizes that the goal of these political organizations is to become part of the American population. And she says, well, but what's the cost of that? What do I lose? I gain, you know, my rights, and I gain a secure place in the world, and I gain community, and I gain, you know, citizenship privileges. But what do I lose culturally? What do I lose as far as my individuality? So she has, you know, for somebody who's lived outside as a criminal and thrived in it, she has real questions about the direction of the LGBTQ civil rights movement. And it's interesting for me to write because I would not have the freedom to write all this or the freedoms that we enjoy now without the LGBTQ civil rights movements. So having to write Cantor, who has not so much doubts, she doesn't doubt this, but she has questions about the direction.
How long does it take you to put together one of these novels?
About a year and a half to 2 years, closer to 2 years, though I'm getting a little faster. The more that I write, I get a little faster. So maybe now a year and a half. But the first one took me close to 4 years because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But recently it takes me about 2 years of constant writing to get a book into the shape that I want it to be. Yeah.
Is that because of a lot of research? Do you have to double check a lot of things for the timing?
Well, I do. Yes. Of course. I have a lot of the research already under my belt, but because the books take place at through the 1950s, as time goes on, there's new research to do about any that, you know, whatever year the book is set in. So part of it is research, but part of it is I write very slowly. I just do. I'm not one of these writers who can sit down and it pours out of me. Occasionally it does, but that lasts about a paragraph. And then it's, and then it's really troweling down into myself to find the book and to hear the characters and to find her and her associates and whatever, and all the secondary characters. So it's a long, slow process for me. I enjoy it though. I have to say that.
You know, and I want to take us back because I'm just fascinated by this idea of, Cantor being a criminal and her absolute desire to state her freedom and the connection between criminality, because LGBTQ people have been criminalized, but then the choice to actually also be a criminal in other ways. I'm actually teaching a class called Be Gay, Do Crime at VCU next in the fall. And so I'm really thinking about both sides of that, both, time periods when people, queer people were criminalized and times, and the choice to maybe be criminal or move outside sort of the traditional moral barriers of particular time periods or just general, moral barriers. Right. Did you, when you were developing this character, did you have that in mind, or was it more, organic? Did it come from a place, that you really kind of thought it out, or was it sort of just your gut speaking to you?
It was both, actually. When you think about it, or when I was thinking about it, I thought about Cantor as a queer person, but also the world she lived in, and the world now. If you live in a world where the law oppresses you and criminalizes you. And wants to, where the society doesn't like you, not only for being queer, but perhaps for being the wrong color or the wrong religion or what have you. What kind of loyalty do you owe a law that thinks you have no rights? So, and, it evolved in my head that Cantor realized she doesn't owe the law any loyalty at all. Now, how I got there was kind of interesting. It was sort of in the back of my mind, but when I started writing the books, I actually had her as a private investigator. But as luck would have it, and Al, we may have talked about this before, I don't know, but I was living and working in San Francisco for a while doing art projects out there. For some of your listeners may or may not know that I was a curator and art exhibition specialist for years. And I was doing this work out in San Francisco. But I had the opportunity, just really by luck, that I wound up working as a report writer for a private investigations firm. So I saw the legal process, the legal system and crime up close and personal. And I realized that the criminal justice system, the legal system, was absolutely corrupt and broken, and I lost all faith in it. So that's when I realized the only way that Cantor, who was an outsider by virtue of being gay at a time when being gay was illegal, the only way that she could keep her honor and her integrity was by being outside the law and being a criminal. She could not work within the law and keep her integrity. So that's how it finally evolved that Cantor Gold became an art thief and a smuggler as opposed to a private investigator.
It's so interesting because I think part of the conversation that I had on that panel at Sleuth Fest about amateur detective versus PI had to do with being an outsider and how amateurs are. I mean, PIs are outsiders too, in a sense, I think.
Yeah. They're odd people.
Yeah. They're more organized out, or they're like almost like their job definition makes them an outsider, or amateurs are more like sly outsiders . It was just interesting, but there's something about the connection between choosing an amateur sleuth, detective, what have you, and being an outsider.
Well, here's something that you might find interesting, John, and you may want to get in touch with Catherine B. Forrest for the opposite point of view. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she was a groundbreaking, and she still is, but...
I actually had a class from Catherine. It was hugely influential in my...
Right. So you know who she is. She was a groundbreaking lesbian author of crime and mystery novels and other things. And of course, she's extremely famous for the Kate Dillafield series. And I just saw Catherine in Albuquerque at the Golden Crown Literary Society conference, and we had this lovely discussion. In any event, her character of Kate Dillafield is relevant to the discussion we're having because she handles the situation in the opposite way of Cantor. She becomes a policewoman.
Right.
She's a cop. And she's a cop in the 80s, where that's when the Dillafield series started. And she had to, and unlike Cantor, the way that Kate Dillafield survives is by being in the closet on her job. But she still believes in the rightness of the law. So, you know, there's two ways of handling our difficulties, you know, our oppression. And Catherine brilliantly has Kate Dillafield handle it in one way. And Kate, you know, to my way of thinking, Kate Dillafield is very brave, despite the fact that she's lives in the closet and she realizes as time goes on the kind of psychological damage that causes her, and for that matter, her relationships. And yet she still has the bravery to go on and create a career in the police department where she helps people and solves crimes and so on. So there's two ways of, you know, here you have two different authors dealing with the same problem of oppression and two different ways of their characters handling that oppression. And I find that really very interesting in terms of not only in terms of social issues, but in terms of art, in terms of literary art.
Yeah, because it kind of approaches the way you tell a story differently.
Exactly. And right? how you think of your, you know, what do you describe as heroism of your character? For me, for Cantor Gold, her heroism comes in the fact that she takes her life in her own hands and she gives the government the big no. For Kate Dillafield, her heroism is that she survives the oppression of the closet and still functions as someone who does good in the world as an officer of the law.
So I think that, you know, it's so interesting because I'm, you know, as I think about my own work, I, you know, have characters who are kind of, you know, even further out there, they're committing crimes. Perhaps we would not agree with these crimes,
you know.
But they're doing it just for this concept or the whole idea of that freedom at all costs, right?
Absolutely.
And even some pretty, maybe the cost is a lot. Maybe we even, you know, might have to wrestle with the cost. But I think that that's such an interesting concept that, you know, that we're approaching the same problem, but from different points of view.
I think very often, LGBTQ crime writers, that might be sort of the central core of our plots, is how do you handle a situation? How do you live in a world that hates you? And so how does your protagonist handle that life? You know, and for Michael Navo with the Rios novels, you know, he's a lawyer. Mm-hmm. He has one way of handling it. Catherine is another. I'm yet another. You're another. But I think that that might be the central core of the directions that we take in having our crime solvers maneuver through a world that essentially doesn't like them and that would prefer that they were not there. Even today, in our time of more acceptance than Cantor's time, don't you still get the feeling that, our allies have given us, the nod to our rights and support our rights and support marriage equality and all of that. But when it really gets down to it, they would sort of prefer that, if that maybe not go away, but that we didn't have to fight, we didn't have to bother them with these issues to help us get our rights and all of that sort of thing. Do you ever get that feeling from the larger world?
Yes, I think there's definitely a sense of you have what you need now, you know.
Yeah, sit down and be quiet. Yeah.
Sit down and be quiet. Yeah. Don't put it in my face, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think you can probably go to any sort of sector, certainly in the writing world, and you see a lot of inequities.
Well, you and I and Greg Herron and and Michael Knob and some of the others are doing something about it. You know, we're all members of Mystery Writers of America and we are on the Queer Advisory Board. Ha ha. to try, you know, to try and get the crime literature's premier organization to take our literature seriously. And, you know, we'll see how successful we are. You know, we're a new group within the Mystery Writers of America. So we'll, but that's our function, is to sort of lobby for getting the premier organization in our genre to give us respect literarily. I mean, no LGBT book has won an Edgar Award. Now, Ellen Hart won the Grandmaster Award, which was wonderful for her body of work. But no book of hers, to my knowledge, was honored with the award. So they honored her for a body of work without ever honoring any one of her books. They just can't go there yet. And we're going to, you know, lobby for them to go there. It's time for them to go there.
That's right.
Yes.
Get out there. Let's just,
yes.
Get out there and let's burn our bras.
Yeah. I bet you're adorable in a bra, Alan. You're far cute. Well,
you know, it depends. Some days.
You're probably as adorable in your bra as I am in my tidy whities.
Yeah. Well, there we go, everyone. Think about that for a minute. At the end of the day, but. So each book in this series, does it have an, I don't want to say that word agenda, because nowadays that's very negative, it seems like, but does it have a meaning to it?
It does. Yeah. Each book sort of has a thematic thread running through it. As I say, in this one, the thread was maintaining your place in the world, the honor of maintaining your place in the world. So yes, each one of the books sort of has a premise, some element of life, of Cantor's life or a friend's life or some client's life, you know, some associate of some element of life is challenged, and resulting in murder and crime and so on that Cantor has to solve and save somebody's life. So yes, there's a theme of some sort of honor or justice or the lack of it that she has to rectify. And in this new one, it's the idea of maintaining your place in the world, whether you're gay or anybody else. But in this case, of course, it's Cantor maintaining her place in the world because someone wants to take it away from her.
When you were creating Cantor, did you have a choice on what you were going to do with her in the sense of, because you've got her as a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just like a thought out choice by you? Or was it just, it just fit the character?
Well, as I said, when I saw the criminal justice system, when I was working for the private investigations firm, writing their investigative reports, you know, I would look at the surveillance tapes and so on and the investigators' notes, and I would have to put it into a narrative, a very dry narrative. You know, they did this, they did this, the suspect went here, there, whatever, for the client. I was at that time, I was thinking about having her as a PI, but my mind was changed when I saw how broken the criminal justice system is. So I had already started writing her as a PI, and I had to rip that up and start all over again when I realized she had to live outside the law because there was no place for her within the law. And that's when she really started to blossom. I was struggling writing her. But once I put her into the criminal world, then she started to speak to me and she really blossomed.
So what is your experience with Cantor? Like, so when you are writing that character into the book or the book about her, do you have an interaction with Cantor? Like, is it like a living being?
That's an interesting question. I do. Excuse me. I do, of course. I hear her as I'm writing. I see her and I hear her and I feel her as I do all the characters in the book. If I didn't hear them or feel them, if I didn't experience through them, then I couldn't write them. But Cantor, of course, being the main character and the one that I've lived with longest as a creator, yes, I hear her. And I, in a manner of speaking, I speak to her. She, however, is not in the least aware of me. She doesn't speak to me. She speaks through me, but not to me. She's not aware of me at all. But how could she be, I suppose? But I am, of course, intensely aware of her. As the creator of all the characters in the book, the recurring characters, as well as the characters that appear just in each, you know, from book to book from, that don't recur, I'm aware of all of them. And the recurring characters are as real to me, of course, as Cantor is. But so are the, you know, so are the ones that die off. They're real to me until they're dead.
Yeah. But, you know, do you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night and find yourself holding a shovel? Or,
yeah.
Or, you know, dirty, muddy shoes sitting beside the bed, and you kind of, well, how did that happen?
Yes, I do. Yes. When I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I have yet to see a body at the foot of the bed, but I will make a note or, yes, things do occur to me. She does interrupt my sleep. And if it's not Cantor who interrupts my sleep, it might be one of the other characters that interrupts my sleep. You know, they talk to me too, or they don't talk to me. No, they don't. They talk through me. But yeah, they interrupt my sleep as well. Absolutely. Sure.
Well, you don't hear these voices when you're driving, do you?
Yes. Unfortunately, I don't drive anymore. But I do hear these voices, you know, when I'm on the subway. Yeah, I do. I hear them all the time. But I do my best not to respond to them when I'm on the subway or whatnot, because, you know, people look at you funny and I don't live
without
that.
They won't even notice. Come on, New York. Come on.
Well, they sort of move away, you know, from.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You get your own seat.
Yeah.
Now, this is interesting because this character is very much a part of you. And so are a lot of the characters in your books, obviously. Mm-hmm. But when it is like that, do you feel a certain responsibility to how you write your character or what you let people know about your character?
Oh, heavens, yes. And that's true for the Cantor books, but it's also true of everything else I write. I write short stories and I have a novella out there and another one that's going to probably come out in a couple of years, a year. Yeah, I think 2 years, something like that. And another book. I wrote another book that isn't a Cantor Gold book that Bywater Books is publishing next year. Yes, I mean, once you create a character, once you write a book and you create a community of characters all doing something and acting out their roles in a drama, you've created them, you've birthed them. So, of course, I have a responsibility towards them. I have a responsibility to portray them accurately and truthfully, whether they're the good guys or the bad girls, you know, it doesn't matter. They have to, their real selves, their human selves have to be portrayed with integrity, my integrity as an author, or it won't ring true to the reader. And I would be cheating the characters. And, you know, when you're writing along, John and Alan, I don't know if you've experienced this, but when you're writing along and you sort of lose that integrity, if something goes, you know it, you know, boy, oh boy, they just go off and they let you know, you know, that you've totally screwed up here. And that, you know, your beautiful prose really has to go into the round file because, you've lost the truth of that character. So yes, I do feel a responsibility towards them. I birthed them. Do you feel a responsibility towards your children? Of course you do.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, no. Well, that's something.
No. Have you ever gone back then, mm-hmm. in this case, to like book one or book two, mm-hmm. and re-looked at it and decide that you wished you had written them differently in those books?
In a way, it's not so much that I wish I had written the characters differently as much as I wish that I had written them better. You know, especially book one, which was my first novel. I had some short stories published, but the first Cantor Gold book, Criminal Gold, was my first novel, my first long form. And in a way, ignorance is bliss. I had no idea what I was doing, but I just plowed ahead and did it. I don't go back and read it a whole lot, but every so often, I'll have to go back and look at it because it is a series. So I have to make sure that, you know, all my facts and timelines line up. And I'll find things where I wish I had written a paragraph better, more musically, or, better rhythm or that sort of thing. I wish the craft were better, but my characters, I'm pretty satisfied with how I depicted my characters even way back then, because I took, you know, like I say, it took me a long time to write them, and I really worked my way through them with a lot of depth. But I do wish I had better craft with book one than I had at the time. But I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah, you weren't the Lambda winner you are now.
No, indeed not. But I was I was with book two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's really interesting? Well, first of all, it just popped in my head, and there was one Edgar Award for a gay author, John Morgan Wilson.
Oh, was there? Oh, I didn't know.
Hmm. Yeah, 97. Yeah, it took me a second to, you know, call. I should have called up his name faster, but I didn't. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's still really rare.
Yeah.
That's not what I want to ask about, though. Now, this is a totally selfish question, because I'm working on the sequel to The Savage Kind.
Oh, good.
And how do you deal, your series writer, how do you deal with not repeating too much of the information from previous books, but enough so mm-hmm. that our reader can pick it up mm-hmm. mid-series and mm-hmm. still find it to be a satisfying read? I mean, is that, you know, talk about going back and rereading. I'm working through it, and I find it to be challenging. So I'm curious if you have any, you know, good tips.
Yeah, you know, I don't find it a problem. I don't know why. I can't answer your question as far as technique. I don't know why I find it a problem, but I am aware that I do have to keep readers, you know, catch readers up. If they haven't read, say, the first four books, they can read book five and, you know, now book six without having read the others. And I usually find a way in a conversation or an action or something where Cantor can remember something or other, or somebody says something that relates to a former situation from an earlier book, so that the reader has now that information about Cantor in their reading arsenal. But I don't sit there and explain. I mean, in a way I do, but it wouldn't be more than a few sentences here, a sure. sentence or two there that brings the reader up to date about why Cantor feels the way she does about something or other. And it may harken back to an earlier book. And usually does harken back to an earlier book that explains why she feels this or that way about somebody or other or some situation. But I don't explain the whole thing. It's just as it happens in the plot, then I can introduce why she feels this way about that. And then, of course, there is the running thing. These are not romance novels, but there's always some, you know, marvelous femme fatale on Cantor's arm. She's a very sexual being. And it doesn't always work out well. Some of these women die. You know, sometimes they're the murder victim. Sometimes they're the killer. But there was a love of her life way back in book one. But we never see her even in book one, the character of Sophie. We never see her because she's been kidnapped. Well, she simply disappeared. We learn later she's been kidnapped, but she's disappeared, and Cantor never finds her until she gets a tip, which takes her into book four, where she goes to Cuba to find her. And I won't give too much away, but, you know, she has to go to Cuba to find her. And we, you know, so we really never see Sophie, but that's the, you know, the fact that the love of Cantor's life was stolen from her. Cantor calls that the wound that will never heal. And that occurs through all of the books. And that's one of Cantor's interior forces that drives her to do the things she does and drives her to be the person she is this loss of a great love.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You don't want to slow readers down, right?
Right.
But you want to make sure they understand the character's motivations.
Yeah. I think the best way to do that is just, or the way that it works for me is to just weave that information into the plot so that it doesn't become this exposition about something, this lecture.
Yeah. Here's a lecture. Here. Yeah. That won't make anyone happy.
No, not at all.
We had John Morgan Wilson on the show.
Aha.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was back September of 2020. I thought so. I thought so.
Yeah, well, I stand corrected.
Awarded the Edgar by the Mystery Writers of America.
It's the first, not his first novel, best first, I think.
Best novel.
Simple Justice.
Was it an LGBTQ? Was it a gay novel? A gay themed novel?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, yeah,
then I stand corrected. Still, one is not exactly.
Yeah, it's like one. So, yeah. I mean, your point still holds.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
One is not enough.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, so how do people get a hold of you? How does Lady Gaga contact you?
Lady Gaga can contact me anytime she likes. although I think she's, isn't she married now? But, you know, so what?
Oh, that never lasts.
Yeah,
long.
Right.
You know, come on.
Let's see, how can people get in touch with me? Well, yeah. Facebook, you know, you can just go Ann Aptaker or Ann Aptaker author at two pages. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I have not yet done TikTok because how do you do authors TikTok? I mean, I haven't figured it out yet, but at some point I probably will have to.
It's the same thing as Instagram. So when you're posting a picture and a little thing on there, you do the same thing. I post the exact same thing on my TikTok.
On your TikTok. And has it worked for you? Do you get, you know?
You know, I get anywhere from 200 to 700 hits per post. So it's not anything magical. And just don't forget to hashtag it, like hashtag book talk, hashtag whatever. It's the same sort of principle.
I see.
People look at it.
Well, I will have to, you know, I will have to, you know, sort of join the TikTok mob at some point.
John's in charge of it, so.
Oh, good.
No, I have yet to join myself. And I was having the same conversation. It's good to know, Al, that you may not have to duplicate your materials. Because, frankly, I'm at three different social medias right now, and you feel like, you know, I'll be posting more than I'll be writing.
Yeah. Oh, there's that. I know that you're. I know.
Well, you guys, you Lambda winners, don't you have your assistants and entourage and agents and publicists and all that stuff? You have like 10 people working for you. They can do it.
You mean my staff of 20? Yeah.
I have a staff of 10, and I'm looking at them right now. I have 5 on each hand.
Yeah. Well, assign one of them that job and it's all done, right?
Right, yeah.
Being in charge is about delegation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing else.
But they complain I work them to death, though, with all of this.
Well, they just feed them less.
Yeah.
Torture. Anyway, so do you run a website too then or no?
Not yet. I've been toying with it. I think, you know, I haven't figured that out yet. I had one and then I didn't have one and I don't have one now, but that doesn't mean that I won't have one in the future. But it's one more thing to, you know, to screw around with the social media and whatnot. And I have all kinds of stuff on my plate. What I need to do is find somebody to set it up for me because I was an abject failure at doing that. So,
Well, John's pretty good at that.
Yeah, I did it myself.
We'll talk.
Okay.
Well, so it's been a great conversation as usual. We had Mrs. Gaga on, and the book, of course, is called Hunting Gold.
Exactly.
And it's book 6 in the Cantor Gold Crime series.
Right.
And the authors are guests, and it's Ann Aptaker. So thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. And John, thank you for showing up. It was great to talk to you again.
And absolutely.
Congratulations on, you know, congratulations on the Lambda. Really proud of you. I was really happy when you won.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino movie reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.